Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, I wanted to remind everyone about our series on the Crusades, Welcome to the Crusades, which you can find at welcometothecrusades.com. If you're into history, if you're into weird, strange medieval stuff, if you're into culture, if you're into war, we really do think you'd like the show. So please check it out. Tell all of your friends. Again, that's welcometothecrusades.com. As always, if you can, please subscribe to the show. We really can't do it without you. And if you can't do that, I wanted to ask everyone to take a moment to review us on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts. It actually really helps the show out. It helps get us out there. And obviously, we want everyone to listen to the show. Maybe we could change some minds in this moment of transition. So if you can, check out welcometothecrusades.com, subscribe to the show. And if you can't do that, please review us on Apple. All right, Derek, let's get into it. And let's start with this International Court of Justice ruling on the climate. What's happened there?
The ICJ issued an advisory ruling on Wednesday with respect to climate change in an effort to not start this week's news off with any of the extremely depressing news that we have to cover. I thought we could mention this because it is not depressing. In fact, the ICJ ruled that states must act to address what it called the existential threat of climate change, which means they have to cooperate to cut emissions. They have to meet their commitments under global climate agreements. They have to protect populations and ecosystems that are vulnerable to climate change from harm. The president of the court, Yuji Iwasawa, went on record to say that climate change, greenhouse emissions are unequivocally caused by human activities. That's a quote. So it's all very positive from the standpoint of climate action, or if you want to, a major international body to take a stand here. This case was brought by the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu and backed by scores of other UN member states. But Vanuatu, obviously very vulnerable to climate change, was looking for a ruling from the court that would, at least in theory, oblige UN members to take action and uphold their commitments to deal with climate change. The downside of this is, as with all things international law, it doesn't have any force behind it. So first of all, it's an advisory opinion, and ICJ advisory opinions are not binding in the same way that when it hears a case and arbitrates between two countries and issues a ruling, those are legally binding, if not practically binding. The other thing, of course, is that the ICJ has no enforcement mechanism. So even if this were a binding ruling, there would be no way for it to force member states to comply with it. What this could do and probably will do is become the basis or part of the basis for lawsuits that countries like Vanuatu, other climate-sensitive states could file against major greenhouse emitters. Whether those cases will ever go anywhere or achieve anything, I leave to people who are perhaps more optimistic and understand the law a little better than I do. Nevertheless, we could see some of that start happening now on the basis of this ruling.
Well, it's a step in the right direction, I guess. All right, let's move on and let's talk about an issue that really hasn't gotten any coverage in the United States, but in my opinion, Derek, and I think you agree, is one of the most important things happening in the world right now, and that is this Thai-Cambodian border clash. Obviously, a region that the U.S. used to care about, but has long stopped caring about. But Derek, what's going on there?
So this really has been simmering for several weeks now. I'm sure we must have talked about it at some point on the news, although I can't remember when that would have been. But it's been simmering for a while now, and it kicked off really in a major way on Thursday. There is, as far as I know, still an open conflict happening along the border. There have been airstrikes. There have been there's been cross-border fire. At least 12 people have been killed, according to Thai officials. I'm not sure if they're... I don't think the Cambodian government's released any figures, but the Thai government says 11 civilians and one soldier have been killed. This goes back to actually a long-standing border dispute that goes all the way back, if you really want, to the French colonial days. And the maps that they drew, go figure, a colonial map causing problems in the modern world. This goes back to a disputes about the lines that the French colonial officials drew on the map. It's been adjudicated by the ICJ, in fact, was adjudicated several years ago. And the ICJ sort of punted it left a major disputed area under Cambodian administration without really resolving the issue finally. And the Thai government has rejected that ruling. And this has remained a sore spot in relations. What's now happened is in late May, there was a clash in a disputed part of the border in which a Cambodian soldier was killed, a clash between Thai and Cambodian border guards that kicked off a weeks of back and forth, kind of, angry missives from the two governments, political turmoil. It cost the prime minister, Prayuttchan Chan-o-ach of Thailand, her job because she engaged in some sort of back channel diplomacy with Hun Sen, who's the former prime minister of Cambodia and now the president of the Senate, and still the most powerful figure in the country. And that the contents of her phone call with him leaked. She was heard criticizing the Thai military, which is a no-no in a country that's still basically, at least under significant military sway, if not outright military rule. So she was suspended from her job. And the two countries have continued to, kind of snipe at each other. Just earlier this week, there was the Thai government accused the Cambodians of planting landmines along the border. This is based on an incident that took place last week where three Thai soldiers were injured on patrol, one of them quite severely. By a landmine that the Thai government accused Cambodia of freshly planting in an area that the two countries have agreed is a normal, serves as a normal path for military forces on patrol. So it should be cleared of mines, it should be protected. The Cambodian government accused the Thai soldiers of having strayed off of that agreed upon route and having run into one or more of the many, many, many pieces of unexploded ordnance that are still in Cambodia from remnants of that country's 20th century history, which is quite violent. So they were disputing that. The Thai government then on Wednesday expelled Cambodia's ambassador from Bangkok, recalled its ambassador from Phnom Penh, and announced border closures, checkpoints along the border in northeastern Thailand, between northeastern Thailand and Cambodia. I am unclear. I'm not sure anybody is clear yet, because this is just happening on Thursday, what caused the shooting. And the two governments are obviously blaming each other, as one would expect in the early hours after something like this happens. But as I said, things have really picked up in a disturbing way just in the last few hours on Thursday. And we'll have to see. I can't get into any more detail than that, because it's still developing, but we'll see how it shakes out.
Let's move on to Syria and talk about the ceasefire that was just reached in the south.
Yes, I know you and Alex talked about the situation in Soweto province last week, with the fighting between the Druze and Bedouin, the Israeli intervention, ostensibly defense of the Druze, which got quite severe. They bombed targets in Damascus. They hit the defense ministry and almost hit the presidential palace, I think, sending a message to Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara. A ceasefire took hold on Saturday, or was imposed at least on Saturday, after the U.S. brokered a tangential ceasefire between the Israelis and the Syrians. The Druze and Bedouin agreed to another ceasefire on Saturday. It was, I think, the third of the week. But this one, unlike the other two, seems to have held. The Syrian government has moved security forces back into Ceuta. I'm sure you guys discussed the aborted intervention last week that turned really into another sectarian massacre, or threatened to turn into another sectarian massacre, with the security forces joining the Bedouin to attack Druze civilians, hundreds of whom were killed. They've sent security forces back into Ceuta, and change of pace, be doing their job this time and not joining in the sectarian violence, but actually stopping it. Over the weekend, they evacuated, and into Monday, they evacuated a number of Bedouin families from Ceuta City. As I say, things seem to be holding tentatively for now. The bigger issues to come, obviously, are the status of Druze militias and Druze authority in this part of the country. The Druze community seems to want significant autonomy, just as, you know, every other Syrian minority group, Kurds, Alawites, you know, want some protection from the kind of reprisal attacks that we saw this week, the kind of reprisal attacks we saw in March when, you know, hundreds of Alawites were massacred again by security forces. The government in Damascus obviously wants these regions to come under central control. The U.S., which has been heavily involved in trying to stand up the Syrian government, also Tom Barak, the U.S. envoy, has been pretty forcefully pushing for a centralized Syrian state and something, not a more federalist model that would give these regions and these communities autonomy. So the U.S. is pushing in that direction. The Syrian government's pushing in that direction. The Turkish government, which is the main patron of the new Syrian government, also pushing in that direction and is supposedly lending its help, for better or worse, to the Syrian government in terms of security. They're all pushing for a centralized state. Every time one of these incidents happens and you have the security forces killing dozens, scores, hundreds of minorities, all the other communities in Syria watch that and say, we don't want a centralized state. It reinforces their desire for autonomy and regionalism. It creates this countervailing pressure. And then, of course, you have the Israelis, who just don't want a functioning Syrian state. I mean, bottom line, there are domestic reasons why the Israeli government intervenes to support Syrian Druze, because the Israeli Druze population feels strongly about that. But also, it just doesn't want there to be a functioning Syrian state. So it will intervene, at least when the United States allows it, Israel will intervene. And sometimes when it doesn't, as was apparently the case last week, the U.S. was not supposedly not happy with those Israeli airstrikes. It's a country that's being buffeted by a number of pressures, and whose government repeatedly fails when put in a crisis situation to manage it properly, and again, you know, not to exacerbate the situation as the security forces did last week.
All right, let's stay in the region and let's move on to Israel-Palestine, and let's talk about this terrible starvation. You see it on Twitter, and it's just really, really, really horrible. But Derek, let's talk about the starvation.
I don't know what to say. I mean, you know, this has been months now, several months just since the latest blockade came down in March, that was, you know, sort of full blockade, but you have to go back all the way to October 2023 and the restriction of food coming into to Gaza, and the cumulative effect of that. We do seem to have hit a tipping point. There have been warnings about malnutrition, about starvation all along, but the situation really does seem to have crossed into a place where people are now dying of starvation, and that's sort of thing can snowball very quickly once you cross that threshold. There were doctors in Gaza Reporting daily death tolls from starvation this week. Not huge death tolls in the big scheme of things compared to how many people are still being killed daily by the Israeli military, but enough to be deeply concerning. A couple dozen people every day, children in particular badly affected, infants, because the Israelis have blocked infant formula from coming into Gaza. It is horrifying what's going on. Hospitals have reported, children being particularly affected by this. And now we've seen this week international agencies reporting their own personnel are starving. The Norwegian Refugee Council, which is one of the aid groups that operates in Gaza, reported earlier this week that it had run out completely of aid. Its own workers are now among, the people. Some of its own staffers are among the people who are critically, without food and at risk of dying. AFP, the news outlet, reported that its Gaza journalists, its freelancers, several of them are starving. It made a plea for to be allowed to evacuate them out of Gaza. As far as I know, that fell on deaf ears. I don't know what else to say. There have been pieces written. There was one in 972 magazine from a journalist in Khan Yunis, Rueda Amer, who wrote about her own starvation and the starvation of her family. I don't know how to convey this other than, I'm sure people have seen the images on social media and read the accounts of people who are living through it. It is absolutely a nightmare, worse than it's been to this point, as hard as that may be to believe.
What about ceasefire talks? Is there any hope?
I don't see much hope. I wish I had a better answer than that. But there have been 2 weeks in this latest round of ceasefire talks, and Hamas issued another response to the latest proposal, reportedly on Wednesday, that from what I've seen reported about it, they asked for a number of changes to the proposal, and the changes that they asked for suggest, and there's no reporting to this effect, but just if you read what they're asking to be amended in the document, it seems like they've really made zero progress over the last 2 weeks, because the issues are still the same. Hamas wants wants the IDF to pull out of Gaza more fully. It's looking at, submitted an amended map of where the IDF would be permitted to operate during the first 60-day phase of a truce. It's still asking for amendments to the language in the deal that would prevent or at least discourage, I guess, the Israelis from simply allowing that 60-day truce to go through and then resuming the starvation campaign, the military campaign. It's asking for amendments to the process by which aid would be brought into the territory, which means the Israelis are still insisting that the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation would be managing the aid distribution. And Hamas is demanding that the GHF, which has done almost as much to get people killed as to feed them, would not be involved, and that it would be the aid distribution would be run by the UN and other international aid groups. These are the same issues that were there 2 weeks ago, so that's why I say it seems like there has been little to no progress. If this is still where the discussion is at, Hamas again, based on the reporting I saw, they're asking for further guarantees that the Israeli government will not pursue the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, which the Israeli government is gleefully, openly talking about still. They're still issuing evacuation orders. They issued one for Deir al-Balah, which is in central Gaza, over the weekend. That's the one city that has been, I don't want to say untouched, but relatively, compared to like Khan Yunis, Rafah, Gaza City, has been relatively spared the brunt of the violence. Now they've entered that city and are clearing people out. Axios reported last week that they'd asked the Trump administration to intervene with in negotiations with three countries, supposed negotiations with three countries, Ethiopia, Indonesia, and Libya, about displacing Palestinians out of the territory. And of course, we talked about this. They have this plan now to eventually move the entire population. They start with about a third of the population of Gaza into what is left of Rafah, which they're calling a humanitarian city. I think it's a concentration camp, but they're using the euphemism humanitarian, and eventually move the whole population of Gaza into that area, from which they could then be transferred out of the territory. So, you know, we're still at these very fundamental issues, like, are you going to commit a crime against humanity here? And the Israelis won't say no. So the negotiations really don't seem to be advancing. I will say Steve Witkoff, the Trump administration envoy, is supposed to be in Europe now on Thursday to negotiate or to discuss the issue with Israeli and Qatari officials. If I guess he likes what he hears at that meeting, he may go to Qatar to try and bring the deal, bring a deal over the finish line. I would say that's unlikely, but you know, happy to be proven wrong, I guess. So that's sort of where things stand.
Let's talk about Iran, which has begun re-engaging with the International Atomic Energy Agency.
This was an interesting development. On Wednesday, the deputy foreign minister of Iran, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that Tehran has agreed to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to send a technical team to Iran at some point in the next few weeks. It didn't specify when. The Iranian government suspended all cooperation with the IAEA after the so-called 12-day war, blamed the IAEA for not doing more to stop that conflict, and in fact for seemingly encouraging it. So the IAEA is doing nothing right now in Iran, as far as I know. It hasn't commented on, at least I haven't seen any comment from the agency on what Gharibabadi said. The meeting that would take place would be, it would not be an inspection team, basically. It would be a political team coming in to sort of discuss the possibility of re-engagement between Iran and the agency. The reason that this matters is, despite whatever destruction took place during the 12-day war, and there's still questions about just how much damage was done to Iran's nuclear program, it was not done away with. And so, you know, you're either going to see the U.S. and Israel over time move toward bombing Iran again, or you're going to have some negotiated settlement. And the only way you get to a negotiated settlement is with IAEA involvement. I mean, I guess you could stand up a different inspections regime, but that would be very difficult and probably pointless. The IAEA is the international agency that manages these sorts of things that would need to be involved in the process to monitor Iranian nuclear sites. So rebuilding this relationship is a prerequisite to finding some non-military way out of this crisis. So I think it's significant that they're starting to re-engage.
Let's go to the Democratic Republic of the Congo and this declaration that was signed with M23.
Right. So last month, folks, I'm sure are aware, we talked about it on the program. The Congolese government and the Rwanda government signed a peace deal of sorts, somewhat tentative. We'll see how it gets implemented. But that deal was tangentially, at least, related to the M23 conflict, in that Rwanda has been the main backer, patron, supporter of the M23 militant group. And in fact, there's arguments that the Rwandan military is leading the M23's offensive in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. So there were negotiations parallel negotiations between the Congolese government and the M23 militant group that are still going on in Qatar, being mediated by the Qatari government. On Saturday, the two sides signed what they called a declaration of principles, in which the headline was that they pledged to sign a full peace agreement no later than August 18th. There are obviously the fact that they didn't sign a peace deal on Saturday means that there's still outstanding issues. And really, they've talked about taking a number of what they've called confidence building steps that would lead into the signing of a peace deal, and have done nothing, as far as I know, to actually go forward with any of those things. These would be things like prisoner exchanges, sending, restarting banking and other kind of basic economic activity in the cities that are under M23 control in the Eastern DRC, things like that. Nothing, there's been no movement on that. So, the prospects for a full peace deal despite this Saturday statement that they signed, don't seem terribly high at this point. We'll see how it goes, but it is significant, I guess, that they signed this declaration of principles and put a deadline in theory on the negotiations on a deal to actually settle the M23 conflict.
Speaking of conflicts, let's move on to the never-ending war in Ukraine, which I'm sure everyone is very proud to have supported at the beginning.
So, yeah, it was another round of peace talks in Istanbul on Wednesday. This was floated earlier this week by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in light of some reporting that suggested that he might be on the outs again with the Trump administration, like seriously on the outs, to the point, if you're a Seymour Hersh fan, you'll have read his piece on this, that the U.S. might be moving to get rid of Zelensky and replace him with Valery Zaluzhny, the former commander of the Ukrainian military. Zelensky has been acting like somebody who feels like he may be under some pressure. He shuffled his cabinet. He appointed a new prime minister, somebody who negotiated the mineral deal, was involved in the mineral negotiations with the U.S., so has some purchase with the Trump administration. In theory, he moved his former prime minister to head the defense ministry, which, if you're worried about a military coup, maybe a good idea to get a guy you trust in charge of the military. All these things speak to somebody who seems to be panicking a little bit. And part of that was that he offered the Russian government a new round of peace talks. So they met in Istanbul. The two sides agreed to a prisoner swap involving 250 POWs on either side and a further exchange of 1,200 prisoners on either side in the near future. They didn't put a timetable on that. That was pretty much it. That was pretty much the only thing they agreed on. There's been talk of ceasefires, but they're on completely different levels. The Ukrainian government wants a full interim ceasefire that would then, would lead into peace talks. The Russians have rejected that repeatedly. They're proposing short-term truces, of a couple of days here and there along specific parts of the front line that would allow medics to get to wounded soldiers or, crews to recover the bodies of dead soldiers. There's also this proposal that the Ukrainian government has been pushing for a summit between Zelensky and Vladimir Putin that the Russians really don't even seem to respond to anymore when the Ukrainians make this offer. One of Putin's arguments is that Zelensky is an illegitimate leader and he refuses to meet, he would refuse to meet with him. There doesn't seem to be any movement on that front either. That's basically where things stand on that front, and then I guess we can get into the domestic situation in Ukraine, which didn't go Zelensky's way this week either.
Let's talk about these protests that have been occurring over Zelensky's accused corruption.
Right. So the parliament, the Ukrainian parliament, passed a bill earlier this week that basically guts the two most important anti-corruption agencies in the Ukrainian government, the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine and the Specialized Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office. There were huge protests on Tuesday in Kyiv and other cities across Ukraine, people demanding that Zelensky veto that bill. Instead, he signed it into law. That generated more protests, as you might imagine. And Zelensky seems to have been cowed a bit by that response. So on Wednesday, He pledged to introduce new legislation that would, he said, ensure the strength of the rule of law system. And he does, there is a report here from that I'm looking at from Reuters on Thursday that he approved draft legislation that would, I don't know if it would completely roll back the bill that passed on Tuesday that he signed into law, but it would certainly take some steps, or it would be intended to take some steps to appease people who are angry about the gutting of these agencies in a country where corruption is still a major issue. You know, at least a perception of corruption. You know, there's the famous Transparency Index, which measures public perceptions of corruption in various countries, and Ukraine does not score well on that index. Let's just leave it at that. So people are attuned to this. They're angry that, that these agencies have been undercut. The European Union also expressed some disdain, let's say, for the new law, suggested that it could affect Ukraine's possibility of membership. So Zelensky's trying to appeal to the EU as well. And that feeds into the public concern, because there is a public sentiment in support of Ukraine joining the European Union. So anything that would harm that is bound to generate some angry responses. Zelensky's argument here is that the two agencies that were gutted were compromised by Russian influence. I haven't seen any reporting of, you know, there's actual like Russian manipulation going on within these agencies. But it's also noteworthy that I don't think, at least based on the reporting that I've read, that there was anything specific to the bill that passed in the parliament that Zelensky signed into law that mentioned anything specifically about rooting out Russian influence in these agencies. But that's now become his justification. And as I say, he may be trying at this point to roll everything back, or at least to create new anti-corruption bodies or something to try and appease the protesters and the EU. We'll see how it goes.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Let's move to Latin America, and let's talk about the prisoner exchanges between the United States, El Salvador, and Venezuela.
On Friday, the Venezuelan government agreed to release 10 imprisoned U.S. nationals, as well as, I believe, 40. They released 48. The U.S. says that they're supposed to release 80 people domestically who've been classified by the U.S. government as political prisoners, in return for which the Salvadoran government agreed to release the 252 Venezuelan nationals whom the Trump administration trafficked to El Salvador back in March to stuff in Nayib Bukele's CICOT prison. Those Venezuelan nationals have now returned to Venezuela. The 10 U.S. nationals have been freed. I'm not sure what the status of these political prisoners who have been released is, but their stories, I guess the things that they've told Venezuelan authorities upon their return, sparked an investigation that Venezuelan Attorney General Tarek Saab announced on Monday into allegations that they were tortured while in Salvadoran custody. That investigation, according to Saab, and this, practically speaking, probably doesn't matter, but we'll focus on Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele and his top aides, his prison director, his justice minister. What import that will actually have for any officials in El Salvador is certainly debatable. But the allegation is being thrown around. Bukele has, denied that these people were mistreated, but they're claiming some pretty heinous stuff took place.
Let's move on to Japan and let's talk about the House of Counselors election.
So the Japanese House of Counselors, which is the upper house of the Japanese Diet, Japanese Parliament, held an election on Sunday for half of its 248 seats. And the ruling coalition, the Liberal Democratic Party and Komeito, the two-party coalition, lost its majority as a result of this election, lost its majority in the upper chamber. A lot of votes, I think, were siphoned off by a right-wing party called Sanseito, a populist right-wing party that has emerged in the last few years, siphoned a lot of votes off of the coalition, and that was enough to cost them their majority. The reason that...
The dog is pissed off.
Yeah, the dog is mad. She's pro-LDP. I try to get her to see reason, but she can't help it. The political fallout from this is likely to cost Japanese Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru his job. Ishiba so far has insisted he's not planning to resign. There have been multiple reports since the election from several Japanese news outlets saying that he is in fact going to resign, or is at least considering it, may make an announcement sometime next month. But Ishiba has now presided over the coalition's loss of its majority in both houses of the Japanese parliament. Last October, the snap election that he called after he became prime minister, after he became LDP leader and prime minister, the party lost its majority in the House of Representatives, or the coalition rather lost its majority in the House of Representatives. And now it's lost its majority in the House of Counselors, which is less powerful in terms of its prerogatives than the House of Representatives, but still, it's an embarrassment. It speaks to a coalition, the coalition that has governed Japan pretty much all since World War II, since the end of World War II, is losing its grip, and so it's unsurprising that there are people who are coming for Ishiba's job at this point. As I say, he's denied these reports. He hasn't denied that he's considering the possibility of resigning, or that an announcement may be coming in the next few weeks. But he has specifically denied that he's planning to resign in the near future. So, just have to wait and see, I guess.
Let's end on our economics corner. Jake, put some economics corner music in and let's talk about these
ringing a stock market bell or
no
something.
I think a stock market bell, maybe a cash register, like ka-ching,
yeah,
ka-ching. That'd be
yeah.
good. Jake, yeah, definitely do that. Let's talk about these trade deals between Japan, the Philippines, and Indonesia.
This kind of feeds off of, or runs off of, the reporting about Ishiba and his job security. One of the reasons that he gave in the immediate aftermath of the election, when questions were coming fast and furious about whether he was going to stay in his job, one of the reasons he gave for sticking around was that he wanted to make sure there was no disruption in tariff negotiations, trade negotiations with the United States ahead of the August 1st deadline that the Trump administration has put for countries to negotiate trade deals, lest they find themselves facing the so-called reciprocal tariffs that Donald Trump announced earlier this year, or some other number that he pulls out of his hind parts, has pulled out of his hind parts in the interim. The Japanese government was one of several that completed trade deals this week. Ishiba's rationale then for sticking around is no longer there. The tariffs range from 15% for Japan to 19% for both the Philippines and Indonesia, two other countries that struck deals. The Indonesian government actually struck its deal with the U.S. last week, but they announced the terms this week. The Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the president of the Philippines, was in Washington earlier this week. He visited the White House on Tuesday to kind of bring that deal across the line. They're both looking at 19% tariffs. They have made significant concessions. Indonesia made several concessions on the importation of U.S. agricultural products, on eliminating export controls on critical minerals. Marcos and the Philippines agreed to 0% tariff on U.S. products, in return for which he got, doesn't seem to be very much of a concession from Trump, to be honest. But Marcos is pretty beholden to the United States at this point. And then, Ishiba's team, the Japanese team, got this 15% tariff, which is down from 25%, the rate that Donald Trump floated earlier this month as a potential Japanese tariff. There's not much more that I have in terms of detail. Trump took to social media to say that Japan had agreed to open their country to trade, including cars and trucks, rice and certain other agricultural products and other things. Whatever that means. Also, the Japanese government has agreed to invest $550 billion, again, this is according to Trump, in the U.S. at Trump's direction. Sounds pretty awful, but who knows? Maybe they'll buy maybe they'll invest in a couple of Trump properties or something like that. These deals are in place, and then there is a potential deal in place, or could be a deal that comes together quickly with the European Union. Things seem to have picked up there pretty quickly after the U.S.-Japan deal was announced. The EU has been negotiating for weeks with the Trump administration. Things as of Monday were going so badly that the EU member states were preparing a pretty substantial package of tariffs and other potential restrictions on U.S. companies, et cetera, in the event that the talks broke down, that they could impose on the U.S. in retaliation for whatever the Trump administration did to them. But by Wednesday, again, after this Japan deal was announced, things seemed to have turned around. There were a number of European officials and U.S. officials who were commenting that negotiations now were suddenly, with the EU, were suddenly going very swimmingly. They seem to be circling the same 15% tariff on EU products the Japanese team was able to negotiate for Japanese products. Possibly, I think the EU had been holding out for 10% tariffs from the U.S., possibly having seen what Japan was able to get. They decided to cut their losses and say, okay, 15% is the best we're going to do. Let's just go with that. But I don't know. We could see an EU deal announced fairly soon, or the talks could break down again, and you could have a trade war with the US and EU on the horizon.
Good stuff. Derek, I was thinking, we don't have a Truth Social account, do we? I think we might want to get on there and sort of reach out to the other side
so you can find that
big, beautiful, squishy center that has been missing from American politics. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. Again, check out the Crusade Show at welcometothecrusades.com. Please consider subscribing to the show itself. And if everyone could go over to Apple Podcasts and just review us, it doesn't take very long, but it does help the show. Thanks again for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.